chat on the game, kick off your flip-flops. You can ask on your couch while you binge watch. However you do it, you gotta ask a friend. And if they don't share, you can ask again.
Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health. Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
How was your drive to school?
Let me tell you. I had to get my iced coffee first. I just can't seem to put it down. My favorite rapper just announced a tour. My phone was buzzing like crazy. I'm so excited. I had to text all my friends right then to talk about it. Then, someone started calling me and...
Let's try that again.
I turned my phone off right away. I never drive distracted.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
I'm John O'Hurley, and I support Paralyzed Veterans of America because our heroes have sacrificed so much for our independence.
I had just come home. I had noticed my legs were swept. Next thing I know, it was 3 weeks later. I was paralyzed. PVA has brought me back to life.
While parachuting with my platoon, my parachute didn't open. It left me paralyzed. I just don't think my family would be as happy as they are without the support that I received from Paralyzed Veterans of America.
For more than 75 years, Paralyzed Veterans of America has kept a promise to never leave a fallen hero behind. That's why Paralyzed Veterans of America is providing specialized medical care, life-changing treatments, benefits our heroes earned, the jobs they want, and the accessible vehicles and homes they need. Our paralyzed veterans have helped us live the lives we enjoy today. It's our turn to give them the best lives possible. To learn more, go to pva.org today.
WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
From Wisconsin Rapids to Stevens Point, your news, talk, and sports is 97.5 FM, locally grown radio.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Steve Kathan. At least 9 deaths are blamed on the icy storm that has pounded parts of the South. In Texas, hundreds of thousands don't have electricity.
Chainsaws roared. Crews worked to clean up icy debris caused by the winter storm.
I was a little shocked. I didn't realize it was going to be this bad.
Customers say frozen limbs are falling on roofs and cars and are blocking roads.
Reporter Paige Hubbard of affiliate KEYE. Heading into the weekend, the Weather Channel's Greg Postel says the northern half of the country is in for bone-chilling temperatures.
Wind chills will be like about minus 50 in Maine over the next couple days. Something to watch as this Arctic air mass moves into the northeast this weekend, but then quickly moves away by early in the week.
The Republican-led House has voted after a debate today to oust Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee, citing anti-Israel comments. The day after his first debt ceiling talks with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, President Biden used the National Prayer Breakfast to urge unity.
Let's just sort of kind of join hands again a little bit. Let's start treating each other with respect. That's what Kevin and I are going to do. Not a joke. We had a good meeting yesterday. I think we got to do it across the board.
Top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer says he plans to resist tying spending cutbacks to the debt talks.
If you want to debate closing tax loopholes, which we did in the IRA and we would like to do more of, if they want to debate spending cuts, that'll be a budget process to do, but it shouldn't be tied to the debt ceiling, plain and simple.
Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders has been picked to give the GOP response to President Biden's State of the Union. CBS's Jim Krasula tells us a free school lunch might come with a certain price if a lawmaker in one state gets his way.
Republican Idaho State Representative Ron Mendive wants children to work for their free school lunches. Mendive says that might cut down on the amount of food students waste. The lawmaker did not say whether he envisions young students sweeping floors or wiping down tables to pay for meals.
Health officials advising people to stop using over-the-counter eye drops, Ezra Care artificial tears that could be causing an outbreak of infections. The CDC reports 55 people in 12 states affected. CBS's Stacy Lynn tells us today was the big day of the year for the groundhog we know as Punxsutawney Phil.
Groundhog! The plump little rodent stared at the crowd, then...
Speaking in Groundhogese, directed this President Dunkle to the proper scroll.
Which said...
I see a shadow on my stage. It's 6 more weeks of winter weather.
Wall Street, the Dow is down 86 points. The NASDAQ is up more than 300. This is CBS News.
This is terrifying.
This is really a whodunit.
This is the moment of truth.
This is 48 Hours.
This is a senseless murder.
This case reads like a movie script. It's just more like a horror movie.
This is real life drama.
This is crazy.
I'm the only person alive that has ever walked out of his own grave.
This is how we make a difference.
This is real.
If it wasn't for 48 Hours, there would have been a funeral.
This is 48 Hours.
Available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1968, Americans were introduced to something new.
This is 60 Minutes. It's a kind of a magazine for television.
5 decades later, 60 Minutes is America's most watched news program.
You believe this is the toughest challenge humanity has ever faced?
Absolutely.
But if you miss the TV broadcast, you can listen to full episodes as a podcast.
That's really clever.
60 Minutes, Sundays on CBS, and available anytime, wherever you get your podcasts.
From the hometown of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM, your news talk and sports station.
Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the Fed raised the interest rates again, and look, you know, I've been saying for a while, it appears to me, and look, I'm just a dumb truck driver, appears to me that the forces to be in the Federal Reserve by aggressively raising rates and saying they're going to raise them again down the road, they want the spur on this recession. You've got Republicans in the House, you know, holding the country hostage over the debt ceiling, seems to want to bring on a massive recession. You look on all the social media apps and all of these pronosticators and all of these pundits saying Armageddon's coming and it's coming in the summer, like they're wishing and hoping and wanting the kind of chaos that, well, the Fed and Republicans seem to be heading us towards. And you go, why? Well, I've been saying for a while, it's to crush workers and put them back in their place. But I've decided to ask somebody who probably knows a lot more about this than I do. That's why I've asked my good friend Mateus Vernango to come talk with us. He's a professor of economics at Bucknell University. You can check out his website, nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com. Good stuff there. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So am I getting this right? I'm looking at the fact that the Fed again raised interest rates, not as aggressively as they did before, but a 0.25% is a pretty good jump. I'm looking at what's going on in the House with this debt ceiling hostage situation. It just seems to me like the forces to be want to cause chaos. If it's not to crush workers who are asking for better wages, it's to make Biden look bad. I'm curious what you're seeing.
I would agree with you. You can come and teach. Don't feel that you don't know what's going on. I think you have a good handle of what's going on. So we'll invite you for a visiting position at Bucknell. Because that's spot on. I think that I would differentiate a little bit between the Fed and Powell and Republicans in Congress in the following things. So I think the Fed wants to cause they may say that they want a soft landing, meaning that they want to stop inflation without causing a recession. The truth is that the downside for the Fed, if they cause a recession in comparison to say they cannot stop inflation, although they're not stopping inflation, stop by itself. At this point, I should say, if you look at the last 6 months of inflation, not the annualized inflation, which is what they show, and the annualized is whatever it is, 6-something or 5-something, but the last 6 months, the annualized inflation is around the target of 2%. So inflation stopped because the price of commodities, oil, energy commodities sort of stopped going up. There are some things like eggs and whatnot, things in the news, but for the most part, inflation stopped. But the downside for the Fed, if they look weak on inflation, is terrible. On the other hand, if there is a recession, not a big deal. I mean, financial markets will be okay with that because what they want to do is stop wages and put the labor class back in its place. The Republicans in Congress, It's more complicated. I think that they want really chaos. You know, it may very well cause the recession. If the Fed already didn't cause a recession, I think that the jury is still out on that. And I think it's very possible that the effects of the interest rates on the housing market that are already visible may, you know, throw us in a recession, and that's already inevitable. But let's say we dodge that bullet and we don't fall into a recession because of the Fed. Then I think Republicans want to throw us in a recession, and then I think it's political, not just, you know, to mess with the working class. I think they also want, I mean, the 20 Republicans that, you know, the whole thing with McCarthy, they if they prove something, is that this group is capable of perhaps for the first time creating a situation in which we not just shut down the government, but actually default on that by not raising the ceiling. I have no inside information on this.
No, there's no inside information. I truly believe they want to shoot the hostage.
I think it's very likely that they want, and they prove that they are willing to do it.
It's one of these things that, you know, it's like you tell a kid don't touch the hot stove. You keep telling them don't touch the hot stove, bad things will happen. They got to touch the hot stove to find out what the bad thing is. I believe there are people who are in the house who are going, well, what's the worst thing can happen? So what, we default on it? We print the money? What's the big deal? Well, so let's walk through this idea then for a little bit, because I've actually had people say, well, so what? What if we default? What if we don't pay any of it back? What's the worst thing that happens?
Well, that's a... it has happened in countries like Argentina when you don't pay foreign debt in general. I mean, countries don't tend to do this to their own currencies. Yeah, in their own currencies, countries normally don't have limits on the ability to spend in their own currency. Normally, Argentina is on the verge of a default, and we defaulted, God knows exactly how many times. But it's on debt in dollars, and we don't print dollars. What happens with that is that, you know, the economy collapses. So Argentina, the GDP collapses, you know, was 20% when last time it happened in 2002. If you go to Greece, that Greece uses the euro and defaulted in euros, you know, so it would never quite defaulted. I should say they always arrange a thing, but it was very similar. But they don't control the euro because essentially that's the European Central Bank. So they are in the hands of a foreign central bank. And GDP is now, 14 years past the crisis in 2010, yeah, and it started in 2008, 22-23% below its peak, the GDP. So imagine shrinking the economy 20% and staying for a whole decade and a half in there. That's what we're talking about. I mean, these people are insane. This is not fun. Italy, that never defaulted, but it's in the same grip of the euro. People ask me, you know, why is, you know, last week Argentina and Brazil talked about a common currency, said, you know, it's a terrible idea because you lose your ability to fund yourself in your own currency. And you know, Italy, that, you know, has not defaulted. It's still below what it was before the crisis, you know, 12 years ago. So those are the reasons why you don't want to default. You know, the inability to pay. I mean, we stop the size of the U.S. federal government is humongous. Think of what we do if we stop, let alone all the other things that U.S. represents globally. You know, the U.S. is, for good or for bad, still we spend whatever, 10 times what the next one spends, you know, in the military. So the consequences for U.S. abroad are inimaginable. So it is difficult to wrap our heads around what they're trying to do. And again, they want to see the, in Portuguese we say the to see this circus barn. You know, they're gonna get it. You know, they're gonna have it is inimaginable to me that we're gonna do that. But I think you're right. And then, so it's not a recession. You see, the danger of that, it's much more complicated than just a mere recession. This would be something unprecedented.
Again, another created crisis, which they're masterful at doing. But you brought up Greece a second ago, and a lot of my conservative friends love to point to Greece and say the United States is going to be just like Greece because we have, what, about 110-120% debt to GDP ratio right now. Greece was something like 600-700, if I remember right. We're not really Greece, but they love to use that as the example. How bad is our debt problem?
We don't have a debt problem. That's the issue. So Greece has a debt problem because they have a it's in euros, and the German and French elites decided that they're not going to pay for the catching up of Greece, or the Greek working class, let alone not even the Greek, the German and the French working class. They're trying to stiff the German and the French working class, let alone let the Greek or the Italian working class have a decent living standards. So it's not the case in the United States. The 120%, whatever it is, 30 something trillion dollars, and GDP is 24, whatever it is. So it's not so huge amount depends on your ability to pay. We have no problem of paying this debt. There is no significant problem of paying the debt in your own currency. There is ability to raise funds. If you think along those lines, we can raise taxes on the wealthy. There are many things that can be done. Even things when it's the same logic as, for example, people talk about the Social Security. We're broke. We cannot pay. Of course, we can pay. There are many ways in which this can be solved. We can extend, Social Security taxes to people that make more money, which we're
not going to do.
Reason. Yes, I know it's political, but that's a political decision. So. But the other thing that I always want to remind people of, so think of this. It's a graph I always show in class. The English economy between 1750 and 1850 had always more than 100% debt-to-GDP ratio. At the peak, which was during the Napoleonic Wars, 1815 or so, it's around 260% of GDP, 260%. And I always ask kids, what happened between 1750 and 1850? And it takes them a while, man. But there is always, thank God, somebody that says the Industrial Revolution. So the biggest change since the Agricultural Revolution in the history of humanity that leads to modernity and the rise of England to be the hegemonic country around the world, the most powerful country that they've seen up to that point, it's done on a pile of debt. The problem with debt is not the debt per se, it's how you use the debt.
Right.
And so the problem I have with the 120% debt, and people say it's excessive. Well, it's excessive depending for what? If you're asking me, for having the kind of services that the working class and the people have, the health that we have, for having the kinds of schools that we have, yes, we're expending too much. But can we have this kind of spending and use it to provide decent standards of living for the working class? Of course we can. So that's part of the problem. It's how we're using the debt, not that we are accumulating it. So incurring in the debt to go to college, I always tell them it's a good idea. But if you don't get a good job and cannot repay it, that's the problem. So right. If you use the money, the debt, to build an infrastructure, to be competitive, to give good working, good jobs to working class people, what's the problem with the debt? There's nothing wrong. We can pay it back. Why? Because we're having productive jobs. We're creating the income that will create the taxes that will pay back eventually, the debt that was accumulated. There is no problem with that. The dynamic of that is easy to understand. And, it's as simple as the rate of growth of the economy has to be higher than the rate of interest on the debt you're accumulating. It's as simple as that. And, and that's doable. By the way, the Fed can help and control the interest rate on long-term bonds of U.S. government. So if they work together, there should be no reason why you should be broke in your own currency. So we're not Greece in that sense. What I'm saying is, if we decided to do what the Greek were forced to do because we're stupid, pardon my French, then, well, sure, we're going to have a catastrophe. But is it necessary to cut that? So in the Greek case, it was a Greek tragedy. It was inevitable. It was out of their hands. I think that the left government of Syriza tried to get away from that. They couldn't. The Germans said no. We don't have that. We have just 20 Republicans, perhaps more, if McCarthy goes with the crazies, that are taking the government hostage and may take it to, and by the way, Biden is right in saying that we shouldn't negotiate. There's no reason for austerity and for cutting spending because of the debt ceiling. There is no reason to do that. So
I
think Biden is absolutely correct.
But here's the thing. I mean, and I had someone explain this to me the other day that I wanted to get your perspective on, because, they're saying, well, all this inflation, it's Biden inflation, and everyone's blaming Joe Biden. And I'm going, this is a moment that, kind of, a historical kind of, anomaly. I mean, we're coming out of a massive recession. You know, the demand was kind of pent up. And it's kind of just like after World War II. This person was explaining to me after World War II, there was kind of a bit of inflation because, you know, we went from a war economy to a production economy. And I remember my grandparents talking about, you know, the boom that was the early 50s and that. But we handled it differently. There was massive government spending on housing and massive government spending on education. There was massive investment that helped offset that. There were strong labor unions that skyrocketed wages. We're not doing those things now.
No. And also this, you know, the recovery, although was fast, you know, we're not even close to, you know, I mean, the amount of, so during the Second World War, inflation was caused by too much demand. You know, there was, you know, the fiscal deficit of the government was of the order of 45% of GDP. We have nothing comparable to that. You know, I mean, people are exaggerating. So this inflation, the inflation is gone. As I said, if you look at the annualized inflation over the last 6 months, it's gone. Inflation is going to be gone. I know that people haven't felt it yet, but in the numbers, it's already gone. And the Fed knows that. I mean, if I know it, you know, you can be sure that the Fed knows this. So the inflation is not. No, I don't think inflation will linger for too long, unless again something happens. The war in Ukraine will continue, so God knows what will happen. You know, but there are many things that helped. For example, the good summer in the winter. The winter is not too cold, and you know, so the price of energy didn't go too much up in Europe. That helps us, and so there are many things that have helped so far. So inflation will not get out of hand. Inflation is only bad. People have to think of why you're trying to solve a problem. Inflation is only bad because it hurts people at the bottom of the income distribution. And so if you want to solve that problem, increase the wages of the relatively poor, you know, and that's the way of solving. Let's increase the minimum wage.
No, let's absolutely. No, I tell the story all the time.
That's the way to start with solving those problems. So I don't think that, you know, that's the issue. But I don't think also that we're not doing the investment and all of those things because of Biden even called his, you know, build back better or whatever it was the name. It was sort of a discussion of, you know, they gave it the name to whatever ended up happening, the anti-inflation sort of, you know, package. So they see this as a package to fight those, you know, supply side snags that allowed prices to go up. But I think that, you know, we're not going to do anything of like that, because that would be, you know, given Democrats, and in particular the sort of more progressive strand of the Democrats that have been asking for something like a new deal for a while, a very strong argument. The issue that transformed, I think, the U.S. in the 40s and 50s and 60s, up to the 60s, you know, when things again got more complicated politically, was that it was so evident that the effort for the war that was brought by the government and that was an extension of the New Deal did work. If you give, you know, and the government spends humongous amounts and goes and spends and gives people housing, education, the JBL, you know, and all of those things get better. And, you know, and that's a dangerous thing. And that's a dangerous thing. So I think that they don't want that kind of thing to happen.
But Mateus, that's socialism. And today we had a vote in the House to say we will take no forms of socialism.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a good debate. So, you know, it's I spend time, you know, nobody knows who Keynes is anymore. But I spend a good time, you know, Keynes is the sort of thinker of all of these ideas that we connect, British thinker connected to all of these ideas in the New Deal and whatnot to some extent. And somebody said, oh, he was a socialist. I said, no, he was a liberal. What happened is that socialists at some point became Keynesians. And so they adopted this idea that government intervention can actually... Keynes' notion was we can save capitalism from itself. So we don't have to be socialist and communist. What we can do is go out and spend, and the government can provide all of the things while you still have a private sector that it's, you know, independent, thriving, and, you know, you have the private enterprise that still dominates the economy, but in a mixed economy in which the government provides the basic services that, you know, everybody needs generously for the working class. And so that arrangement, you know, the socialists said, oh, you know what, we're okay with that. So keep capitalism, but we'll go for this kind of stuff. So it's the socialists that became Keynesian. And conservatives for a while became Keynesian. And so that was the consensus of the 50s and 60s that did work out. But, you know, society is complicated. You know, sometimes you don't just want to be doing well. What you want is to be better than the other guy. And so I think that that's part of what, you know, led to the break of that compromise.
Now, last question I've got for you. You know, I keep hearing people talking about, you know, this summer is going to be the end of humanity, the end of the world. Armageddon's coming. Wall Street's going to crash. Your stocks are going. Everything. It's all over, Mateus. There's a realignment. It's, you know, the deep state. You know, whatever. However you want to frame it. Are we concerned that the end of the world is coming in the summer?
I'm afraid what they're going to do. Even I'll say this, even if they allow for a default or a shutdown of the government, I don't think we're going to be Greece even. You know, so I don't think we can live 15 years of, you know, below the 20% below the GDP level of, you know, the peak. So what I think the cooler heads in the Republican Party will prevail. What I do think is that they can take a significant sort of price for that, and that might have implications for 2024 for the election. So I think that's a possible scenario. So I think that the Republicans, very dangerously, let's say the party-trained Republicans, they're using the crazy ones to obtain concessions from the government. But those concessions can come with a price that it's very high. Yeah, because we don't know who wins in 2024, and we know I know. Look at Brazil, the copycat, you know, stuff has been very hard. Democracy is in line, and so 2024, we don't know who comes. You know, Ron DeSantis, yeah. Trump himself. So it's very dangerous. We're playing with fire.
There you go, Mateus. I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Check out the website nakedkeynesianism.blogspot.com if you want to check out Mateus Venango's writings. Appreciate the time, man.
Thank you. No, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. You want to take a quick break, right back. The potty trained ones. I'm stealing that. I am stealing that. Right back after this. Stick around. If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to therickssmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at therickssmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
The potty-trained ones. I'm definitely stealing that. Because it's a perfect frame. I mean, again, you look at, you know, today, the shenanigans that went on in the House of Representatives. And of course, you know, They went after Ilhan Omar and they expelled her from her committee, which you knew was going to happen. You know, you knew it was going to happen. They were going to find their reason, and for me, the reality is Democrats had to expect this was going to happen, because this is retribution, and it's about the right using this as a tool to raise money. Our politics, you know, our governance anymore with the people who are in charge there, it's not about getting stuff done, because what's gotten done since they got there? Nothing. It's all about feeding the outrage machine. It's all been about, you know, all negative stuff. And now we find that there's a Chinese spy.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the last segment of the day. If you got something to say, hit us up right now for your crudités at 844-967-2789.
I thought they were crudy takes.
Crudies takes. See, man, it all comes back around to Sports Talk Live.
Something like that.
My wife wants some vegetables for crudité.
You know what I mean?
Listen Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. for the Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy. You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with a link.
Okay.
Smart.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Data shows that after a child turns 9 in foster care, they are much less likely to be adopted. But the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption believes every child is adoptable.
Families, if you're able to let your hair down a little bit, there's a lot to learn from teenagers.
The clock is ticking for teens at risk of aging out of foster care. Learn how you can help at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
I'm Naheem Hines, professional football player
and proud supporter of the Muscular Dystrophy Association.
My mom was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy when I was 14, and I watched her struggle. But MDA helped her get the best treatments and care, and they also help kids like my buddy Ethan.
My name is Ethan, and I'm 12 years old. Thanks to the Muscular Dystrophy Association and people like you, I have more hope than ever before. From day one, they've treated me like family at my local care center. MDA is the only one that funds over 150 care centers across the U.S. to help provide state-of-the-art care for adults and kids like me.
For over 70 years, MDA has been transforming the lives of people living with muscular dystrophy, ALS, and other related neuromuscular diseases. They fund the research for breakthrough treatments, care, and cures. And MDA provides support to thousands of families like mine and Ethan's in communities like yours. Thanks to MDA, kids and adults can live life to its fullest. Join us and learn more at MDA.org today.
I'm Tumani. When I was younger, I may have did some stupid things. I committed some crimes and even got shot, but I'm not a criminal.
That's right. I'm Jamal. I work for Youth Advocate Programs. Yeah, I was Tumani's advocate, helping him stay out of jail, stay in the neighborhood, get a job, and work hard to see a better future for himself. If you have a change of mindset, you can have a change of action.
As a little kid, I experienced trauma and I acted out. Made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake.
No, she's a good student and a great kid. As Jalen's Yap advocate, I'm always here for her. With the Youth Advocate Programs, I was able to connect with Jalen.
YAP is a community-based alternative to youth incarceration, congregate placement, and neighborhood violence. After completing our program, 86% of participants were arrest-free. YAP works.
And now, I'm a YAP advocate, helping kids like me find a better way.
Youth Advocate Programs. Others talk social change. We make it happen. Learn how at yapinc.org.
As you go about your daily life, look closer. As you gather with family and friends, look closer. Right in your community, there are youth who don't have the home, warmth, and healing you have. So, look closer. Every year across America, a staggering 4.2 million youth are homeless or trafficked. Covenant House is the national leader providing safe housing for youth 50 years strong. Tonight, 2,000 young people will sleep safely in a Covenant House bed. And tomorrow, they will wake up surrounded by love. Every youth who walks into Covenant House gets clean clothes, hot meals, medical care, and a safe place to sleep 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in sites across America to help them fulfill the great promise of their lives. So look closer at Covenant House and help us fight youth homelessness. To help or get help, go to covenanthouse.org.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. And she didn't know whether she should go forward or turn or just stay at the stop sign. She wasn't even really sure where she was at. She was very concerned. It was very unsettling for her.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it, to bring the family in on it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, I don't want you to worry or be afraid. I'll be there for you and we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio, WFHR. A wind chill advisory continues until noon tomorrow. Mainly clear skies tonight with a low of 14 below. Northwest winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Mainly clear skies and quiet again tomorrow. Highs level off around 5 above. Lows level off around 1 above. Tomorrow night, cloudy skies. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 5 above.
Stop surfing the dial. You've found the greatest station ever. Locally grown radio 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM.
How about we start with making family lead a paid benefit so that we want to bring children into the world? Here's, a start. And here to share some thoughts on the 30th anniversary of the Family Medical Leave Act, I've asked Emily Andrews to come talk with us. She's the director of the Education, Labor, and Worker Justice Program there at the Center for Law and Social Policy. CLASP.org is their website. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. It's wonderful to be here.
So this, at the time, was a huge victory. And I don't know, you probably don't remember it, but it was an enormous victory at the time for working people to say, look, if we get sick, if I have a loved one who's sick, if we bring children into the world, this gives us a right to spend time with them, which had not been there before. But, you know, it's one of those things where average everyday working people can't afford to take extended periods of time without pay. So while it was a huge victory, It came at a cost, I thought.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I wasn't old enough to be fighting for it, but I am older than paid family medical leave. Yes, it was a watershed moment. It was a huge boon to workers' rights, workers' protection. There was nothing before it. It's an incredibly important piece of legislation. And still to this day, last year alone, 15 million workers took leave under FMLA, and they were able to return to their jobs, and they were able to have health insurance continue while they were on leave. And it's not just the pay. The FMLA itself, even though it is a huge protection for workers, itself is flawed. There's restrictions there. And unfortunately, due to those restrictions about how big the employer, the size of the employer, over how long you've worked for that employer, how many hours you worked in the last year, all of these things can reduce your eligibility for even unpaid leave.
Yeah.
So in this system that we're currently operating under, only 44% of working Americans are ineligible for even unpaid leave protections, which is just criminal.
Yeah, and the thing is, well, again, you go back, this was historic at the time, 30 years ago, and at the time we took what we could get. And I remember the argument being, hey, this is a massive step forward. This is an enormous victory for working people. We're going to get to the next place. We're going to, at the time, everyone was talking about trying to tie it to unemployment benefits to say, hey, look, you can't work because we'll open it up to unemployment so that people could get at least a little bit of resource to live on. That's over the years hasn't happened. And we were told, you know, all of these other things that weeded people out, we would work towards down the line, like a lot of social programs, you know, like Medicare and Medicaid. We were told that was the analogy we were giving. We'd make it better. We haven't really done that, have we?
No, unfortunately. You know, there's a number of bills just to even prove the number of folks who are covered by FMLA that can't make it across the finish line. And then there's this huge question of the need for paid leave in this country. We are the only industrialized country without paid leave. It's just shocking. And so, of course, you know, the biggest obstacle to taking FMLA is that folks can't afford it. They can't afford to be off work for 12 weeks. Very few workers can afford that. And so that is the next step. And so the anniversary is bittersweet because it was supposed to be a first step. And here we are 30 years later, and we have not taken the next step.
I over my lifetime, I've used it. I think I've used it five times. You know, my ex-wife's parents were terminally ill. I used it incrementally. We were able to use incremental days to take them back and forth to the hospital. When each of my children were born, I have three children. We took I took 6 weeks with two of them, 7 weeks with one, because that's what we could afford. Mm-hmm. Would I have loved to spend all 12 weeks with the children when they came home? Absolutely. But back to that paid component part of it, just couldn't do it. It didn't have the resources to do. Do you find that's what we're seeing people would want like me to take those additional weeks, but the resource just aren't there? Because again, I come back to this. We're told, you know, there are certain, you know, political parties that are family values, folks, and that we love the children. And I'm sure you've heard that rhetoric time and time again.
Familiar. Yes, it does.
This seems like a perfect place to, you know, I don't know, put up or shut up.
I 100% agree. And I don't think it's just that individuals want to take this leave. So many workers need to take this leave. So I'll tell my own leave story. I am a mother, and you know, even in the best circumstances, childbirth is an incredibly difficult experience. It can leave you battered and bruised, and millions of women have to go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. When I gave birth, 2 weeks, I couldn't even walk upstairs. I couldn't walk upstairs until my third week after postpartum. I couldn't even fathom going back to work, having to drive a car, having to be in an office 8 hours a day, much less having to be on a factory floor, having to be, you know, whatever my job, in a service sector job where I'm on my feet all day. It would have been unthinkable. But actually, this is the reality we're living under. And this is the reality that many politicians who claim, exactly as you're saying, to be for, in favor of families, this is the reality that they've left us with.
Yeah, no, I go back to my own experience. I've always been a union member. I've always been fortunate enough to be protected by labor union contracts. And I remember the first time I went to use it for the birth of a child, company told me, no, you can't take it. That doesn't cover that. We're not letting you go. You can't have it. And I'm like, I'm going because it's the law, and filed grievance and all this stuff. And my mind, where I'm at now, is I wonder how many people companies are able to bully them into believing that it's not covered, and then they don't get to take it. And again, there's so many of these scenarios where, again, we were told this was going to be improved as we went down the road, that we should be on this anniversary committing that in 30 years from now, we get to the place where we need to be, or in 3 years.
Yes. And even when folks have the right to paid leave, you know, 11 states and the District of Columbia have passed paid leave legislation. And we find one of the top reasons why workers don't take it is because they're fearful of retaliation and losing their jobs. And so even when there is job protection written into this legislation, the power balance of this country still allows employers to, you know, put the fear within workers that they'll lose their jobs. So yes, I think more education is always needed around these bills, and, you know, more enforcement.
And again, I come back to, as I always do when we talk about employment, another reason, another example of why every working person needs to have a union contract to protect them and give them job security on the job so that they have the ability to stand up for their rights. And this is a working person's right. This was fought for. You know, I remember, you know, phone calls and letters and marching and all kinds of stuff to get this done. This was meant for people to take. This was meant as, well, to help families and to have, well, these employers be able to bully and harass and intimidate is not what the intention of the law was.
Of course not. And this is why I love this show. There is no better job protection than a union contract. And we've talked before about how excited we are to see this big wave of organizing. We need to see more of it because union, there's strength in numbers, and union contracts and unions can protect workers.
Now, here's the thing. And now we've been talking about it from the workers' perspective. And look, I'm all about working people getting the best opportunities they can, not just for the work that they do, but for their families and balanced life, work balance and all that stuff as well. But this is also good for employers as well, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. We've seen that in states that have passed, you know, for FMLA, most definitely, for paid leave, yes, of course. We've seen in states that have passed paid family leave, there is good returns for businesses. We see turnover drop. We see the women's connection to the labor force be maintained. A lot of times when women have to, or anyone has to leave their job, instead of being able to take leave, then that employer needs to hire new staff, needs to train new people. We see reduced turnover when we have both FMLA and paid family leave. We also see a real benefit for small employers when we have paid family leave mandated by the state. So it can be hard for small employers to compete with big businesses who are able to offer these benefits. And so things like a mandate and a state-sponsored paid family leave program really helps small businesses compete.
No, and this is where, again, I come back to the unemployment system as a perfect mechanism to do this. It was a good idea back 30 years ago, and I think it's a good idea now.
Yeah, I mean, we got to figure it out. One of the, you know, what's before Congress right now is the Family Act. And this has been introduced multiple times. And this is a guaranteed comprehensive paid family leave program. How this would work is it's a payroll tax. There's a small tax on payroll for employees. There's a tax on employers. And so it's really a social insurance system. And the way it breaks down for the tax on employees, the average worker would pay about $2 a week. So it's like a cup of coffee for a guaranteed benefit of paid family leave whenever you need it. So that's really kind of how we're thinking about how to pay for a social insurance paid leave program. Everybody buys in. It's kind of owned by the people, and they get to take it when they need it.
But isn't that what unemployment is? I mean, it's the same exact thing. The employers pay into it. The employees pay into it. It's a social insurance program.
It seems like
if we were to have a conversation around, you know, how we provide a safety net for working people that was much more comprehensive than these Band-Aids and these piecemeal programs, we would come up with a better system. But the problem is we've got so many people who tell us that they believe in family values and they love the children doing these performative things like we saw today in the House of Representatives saying we decry socialism and we'll do nothing, no forms of socialism. And yet, you know, Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, public safety laws, worker compensation laws, all of these things have a component of social to them. That completely out of their minds. And this is why we can't have nice things.
That's right. I mean, the scary part is there's actually some very damaging Republican proposals. For example, Marco Rubio's got an idea that instead of funding a paid leave program, workers could actually steal from their future Social Security earnings. And so we're talking about really like robbing yourself of a secure retirement in your old age and using that money for paid leave now.
Which is literally the dumbest thing anyone could ever propose. And if you ask any money manager ever, you know, because we just sat down with my kids. You know, my son's 16, my oldest daughter's 20. You know, when they first got their first job, 15 years old, we got them into a Roth IRA and said, you never touch this, ever.
Right.
Not until you get to the end. And if you do, I'll come back and I'll beat you myself. To have a policy that says, no, that's okay, is irresponsible on steroids and kind of shows me exactly what they think of working people. Now, I guess last line of questioning I got two lines of questioning. First, the negative, because we were told, and I want to get your thoughts if this is out there. We were told 30 years ago that this would be rife with fraud, abuse, and waste, and people were going to abuse this program like none other. Do you find that working people are abusing this, that they're taking advantage of the good-heartedness of this program and their employers as was predicted back then by a certain political party and the foes of this?
Absolutely not. I don't have the cold hard fraud statistics for you, but I can tell you as both, you know, I was actually a union steward and a union member, and I, you know, helping folks through their FMLA process. This is serious business. This is when folks need, they're in crisis, they need help, they need to take leave to be with their families or to care for themselves. And it's, you know, there's medical certification required, there's all kinds of verification required. So no, we don't see huge fraud with FMLA.
Yeah, again, you hit on a buzzword there that most people probably don't know what is. You said you were a union steward, and this is, again, another reason why I believe people should be have union contracts and be members of unions, because they have people like you who can help them navigate things like family medical leave, like unemployment when times hit, and they don't know all of the angles and they don't know all of the information. There's a network of help there, and I think that's really important. So last question I've got for you. What do we do from this point? It's great. We've got this anniversary. Recognize the victory that it was. But the commitment forward has got to be, we've got to do better. What should we be doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know the answer. It's organize, organize, organize. But there's some exciting movement. You know, we did, with the Build Back Better legislation that passed the House last year, it was a high watermark for paid leave because it was included in that bill. So we need to hold on to that idea and that victory. We need to push for a guaranteed federal paid leave program. And there's a lot of exciting movement happening in the states. As I mentioned, 11 states in the District of Columbia have already passed a paid leave law that guarantees workers in those states paid leave. And it just keeps rolling. There's the election in 2022, we saw some Democratic trifectas come into play. And so those states are now thinking about passing paid leave legislation. It's not the perfect solution. It leaves out a lot of states. It particularly leaves out southern states where we know there's a high concentration of workers of color who are not going to get this state paid leave policy because of the Republicans who control those states. And so we really need to keep our eyes on the prize, which is a federal program.
Got a lot of work to do. But again, today, take the victory. But commit to making it better tomorrow, and we will be doing that. Emily, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again real soon.
Would love to. Thanks so much for having me.
Outstanding. Emily Andrews. She is, like I said, the Director of Education, Labor, and Worker Justice at the Center for Law and Social Policy. CLASP.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at their website. Can take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1929, and 3,000 workers in New South Wales, Australia, were locked out of their jobs. Australia was in the midst of the Great Depression. A judge had ruled that the timber industry could increase the work week from 44 hours to 48, while simultaneously lowering the workers' wages. Standing firm in opposition, the workers refused to comply with the mandatory 4-hour increase in work without pay. The company responded by charging in the courts that the workers had gone on strike. This invoked penalties under the 1928 Arbitration Amendment Act. During the strike, women played an important role, holding weekly meetings and gathering food donations from throughout Sydney for the families impacted by the lockout. Women delivered speeches in support of the strikers, harassed scab workers, and held fundraisers to support the cause. Trade unions in the city also supported the strike, holding a rally of 25,000 workers in March. Then, the same judge who had decided on the increase in hours ordered the union to hold a secret ballot vote on the issue of the strike. This marked the first time a secret ballot vote over a strike had occurred in Australia. In a protest demonstration, 3,000 timber workers burned their ballots in defiance. They also burned an effigy of the judge. When the secret vote finally occurred, management's proposals were roundly defeated by a margin of more than 5-1. In the end, however, it was a losing battle. The ravages of the Great Depression were too much to overcome. After more than 8 weeks on strike, the workers returned to the 48-hour workweek. Leaders of the strike faced criminal charges of unlawful conspiracy by violence and threats of violence, but were eventually acquitted by a jury. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So again, it's hard to believe it's been 30 years. And it's been equally hard to believe that we haven't made things better. This is, you know, I go back to, and I remember the argument being, you know, take the win. You know, there's no paid component. Take the win on family medical leave, and we'll get to it. We'll do what they did to Social Security, to Medicare. Really to Medicare, because Medicare, when it first passed, wasn't that great of a benefit. It really wasn't. It was mostly for the very poor. It was, you know, and over the years, people, hey, this isn't bad. We like this. Hey, we should do more of this. Hey, we want more. Yeah, more. And it expanded. They kept, because people wanted more. This didn't happen that way. And a lot of it had to do by the fact that Republicans did a masterful job of blocking it. Corporate pushback was huge. And at the time, the fact that this got pushed through was just incredible. And I remember, you know, our union at the time was pushing for it and, you know, doing some lobbying and doing some stuff around letter writing campaigns and stuff that we did back then. And legislators, you know, telling, you know, the stories of, you know, being just, you know, like no other, being lobbied on this issue. Now, understand, you know, 30 years ago, lobbying was nothing like it is today. It wasn't the industry that it is today. The pressure that they felt to stop this was nowhere close to the amount of full-on, you know, coordinated attacks that would happen today. And what's happened over these years is, corporate America has gotten a lot smarter, and this is another one of those issues that working people want. You ask anybody who's used it, and they're grateful for it. I'm grateful for the chance to have spent time when our kids were born, to just be there with them in those first days. Whereas before, you went to work the next day. You didn't go to work the day of sometimes. Corporate America has done an amazing job of building an echo chamber of right-wing media outlets and powerful voices of a lobbying arm that is second to none, of a think tank structure that creates, you know, all this chaos and all this stuff, that this propaganda. Because again, you think about today. In the House of Representatives, they said no forms of socialism, none whatsoever, nothing. Would something like the Family Medical Leave Act pass today? Could it happen? And I no. The answer is flat out no. Could any of the things that helped build the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization, National Labor Relations Act, Social Security, unemployment, minimum wage, maximum hour laws, could any of those things pass in today's environment? The answer is no, because corporate America has got us by the, you know, the FCC. This is one of those moments where we've got to ask ourselves, when these performative displays, when the children who haven't been potty trained yet have their little fits and need attention and pursue resolutions that have no means, no enforcement, no reason other than the outrage and divide, do we eventually say no? Enough? Do we throw these bums out? Because again, family leave is one of those things that, look, I've talked about it over the years of how I've been fortunate to use it. for 6-7 weeks at a time. It's the most we could afford.
Hey, everybody. Glad you could join us. I'm Tim Hubbelt, better known as the Polka Guy, on the Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show.
Join Tim every Saturday and Sunday for a great variety of polkas, waltzes, and more. Wake up at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning to get the weekend started on the right foot, then enjoy a lively Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. Same great show, two different times, one fun weekend. The Sunshine Polka Party Variety Show, 7 a.m. Saturdays and 1 p.m. Sundays, only on WFHR, locally grown radio.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces. Just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at